to the third case on the call this morning, which is United States v. Johnny Lane, appeal number 09-1057.
May it please the Court, Michael Nash for Johnny Lane. The first issue that I would like to address is the possession of the cocaine found in the northwest bedroom. The government's theory at trial was to prove that the cocaine, which was found in a dirty sock in a hamper, at the bottom of that hamper in the northwest bedroom, was Lane's bedroom, and therefore, by the case law, constructive possession was his of that cocaine. The occupation of that bedroom was established at trial through the opinion of Officer Conley, who, when asked where the cocaine was found, said the northwest bedroom, and then was asked if he could determine who that bedroom belonged to, and he answered it was Mia Kelly's and Johnny Lane's. The prosecutor then asked, how did you determine that? And the officer said, his wallet was found on the dresser with identification in it, and clothes consistent with a man's build, like Lane's, was there also. That opinion evidence by Officer Conley is not admissible or should not have been admissible. Neither the wallet, the identification, or the clothing was entered into evidence. The government, in its brief, argues that there was substantial evidence regarding the fact that it was his bedroom, but none of those facts were relied on or discussed in the district court. The only evidence as to the possession of the bedroom and therefore of the cocaine was Officer Conley's, and in their final argument to the jury, they said it was found in his sock, in his hamper, in his bedroom. And that opinion is just that, only his opinion. Under Rule 701, Federal Rules of Evidence, that opinion should not have been admitted because not the wallet, not the clothing, not the identification was before the jury. In effect, what Officer Conley was saying was that those pieces of evidence not before the jury was what was said.
The testimony about those pieces of evidence was before the jury. There's no requirement that the physical evidence itself be admitted in order to get the opinion testimony in.
But it was his determination. We don't know what the evidence was. We don't know what
The evidence was his testimony about where he found those items and how he connected them to the defendant. And then there was also the process of elimination because the only other bedroom in the house was the children's. There were two bedrooms in the house. One was obviously a children's bedroom. The other was obviously the couple's bedroom. And, you know, there were logical inferences to be drawn from that observation, which was a first-hand observation on the part of the officer, in addition to the other observations about the identification and so forth.
Why?
It doesn't require the physical evidence to be admitted.
It doesn't require it, but if the officer is giving his opinion, which clearly he was, he said he was asked, did you determine whose bedroom? Yes, I determined from three things not in evidence.
You're not getting my question.
I am, Judge.
Items don't have to physically be in evidence. All that's necessary is his testimony about those pieces of physical evidence, where he found them, and what they showed. And that's enough to admit the lay opinion.
I would disagree with Your Honor. I do understand what you're saying, but I would disagree. There are cases that we cited in our brief that in order for him to give his opinion, which is what he was doing, those items should be before the jury.
You mean like the clothing that was in the closet?
Let the jury make the judgment of whether the clothing is consistent with a man of his build.
He can't say that. You have to bring in all the clothes that was in the closet that formed the basis for his opinion.
They could bring some of them. They could certainly put the wallet in. They could certainly put the identification in. They want to argue that it's his house and his bedroom. They have two witnesses who live in the house, neither of whom are asked whether or not He occupied the house or occupied the bedroom. The only evidence is what Officer Connolly says, in fact, the wallet and the identification show and the clothing show. As to the second point, the 851 notification, we cited this court's recent opinion in Williams, which describes the frustration, I believe is the correct word, of this court regarding the 851 filings by in these drug cases. In this case, it's somewhat different. One is clearly a misdemeanor, not a felony. The government acknowledges that in its brief. The second is not an offense. It's not just not a felony, it's not an offense. In effect, the third one has the right date but the wrong offense. And in this case, those two of those three are not felonies. The government says, well, there's no objection made in the lower court at the time of sentencing or otherwise, referring to the statute's requirement to be made after conviction but before sentence. But there was nothing for the defendant to deny or affirm. On the face of the 851 notice, it was inadequate. There is no crime other narcotic, and as they acknowledge, one was clearly a misdemeanor. In that case, the government has not fulfilled its obligation under 851, and the sentence should be reversed and remanded to the district court for resentencing in that case. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Right. Mr. Hartzer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address what I think is the most important issue for the government in this case that Mr. Nash has not addressed, and that's the standard review on the 851, the notice of prior conviction. There was no objection to the notice that was filed. The notice was inaccurate in some respects. It did identify a misdemeanor as a felony, but identified two other felonies. But I'm hoping the court will address the standard review in this case because it will become important for the parties and presumably for the court in the future, perhaps as a result of Williams. I'd like to think that all government prosecutors are now aware of the reprimand that this court issued in its Williams opinion, and we will no longer see sloppy, inaccurate, or problematic 851 notices. But that may be wishful thinking. There will be some that will have errors in them. And the time to catch the errors, it really is in the district court. And I don't mean to impose a burden on the defendant to get it accurate, but you would expect the defendant to be able to, or should be required to object so that the prosecution then has an opportunity to improve or correct the 851, to get it right before we go to sentencing or go to trial. And that didn't happen in this case. There was no objection to this 851 notice. And you can understand why there wasn't any objection, because two of the felonies were correct. They weren't identified correctly. They were mislabeled. But there was no contest as to whether or not he had two prior felony drug convictions. So my point is that there certainly was no plain error in this case, but I'm hoping that the court will, should it write a published opinion, focus on the standard of review in this case, because it's an important standard of review where we cannot allow a defendant to, in effect, sandbag. You can imagine the situation that could occur where a defendant observes a mistake in the 851 notice and decides, oh, I'll just wait until I get to the Court of Appeals, because if I notify the government now and the court now that there's a mistake, it will be corrected and the problem and the issue will disappear. So I'll just wait till I get to the Court of Appeals, and then I can challenge the sentence and possibly, I see your...
Mr. Hartzer, could the district court judge have ascertained the error without objection by the defense counsel?
Could he have what the error?
Could he have known about the error without the objection of defense counsel?
Well, I'm sure the district court could have known about the error.
Based on the record.
Oh, he did not say anything in the record that I saw. No, I don't believe the district court
Well, the judge, in practical matter, isn't going to look behind that thing unless there's somebody that calls it to his attention.
I think that's fair. I think the district court judge would rely on the pre-sentence report that correctly identified the two felonies, recognizing that there had been a notice filed prior to the trial. So it was a timely notice. By the time they got to sentencing, typically the parties are focused on the accuracy of the pre-sentence report.
And both had an opportunity to object.
Had an opportunity to object to both the 851 and to the paragraphs in the pre-sentence report. And there was no objection. So there was no plain error in this case. And I would hope that you would disregard Mr. Nash's appeal to suggest that plain error is not the appropriate standard.
The notice issued the correct case numbers and dates and jurisdictions of conviction, but just not the right name of the crime. Is that
the date, the jurisdiction, and the classification of two of them? The notice, the classification being felonies.
Okay. Not a case number.
It did not give a case number in the 851 notice. That's correct. It did not identify the correct date of conviction, the correct location. I believe both were in Cook County, and the correct classification and the nature of the offenses. I mean, both were obviously drug felonies. That's what the 851 notice is all about. So.
Right, but they just mislabeled in terms of the name of the offense. That was the mistake, apparently.
Correct, yes. Oh, yes, definitely mislabeled, yes.
Okay.
Regarding the officer's opinion, I would only note that the defendant does not challenge the conspiracy conviction in this case, and that has a ripple effect. Because it wasn't simply a conspiracy among two people in which they agreed to distribute cocaine on this particular day, the day of the search. This was a long-standing conspiracy involving a number of people who testified, two of whom testified, that this defendant, Mr. Lane, possessed crack cocaine on a daily basis. I mean, he pretty much always had crack cocaine. So on the day of the search, I think you can draw the inference that he had crack cocaine. And the point that we've tried to make is that, in our brief, is that even without Officer Connolly's testimony, there was sufficient evidence to establish that the crack cocaine in that bedroom belonged to Mr. Lane, that he had constructive possession. Bear in mind, there are three people in the house, one of whom was asked about two of the three quantities of crack cocaine that were found. He identified two of them, the one beneath the air mattress and the larger amount in the basement, as his. That was Mr. Barnes. Didn't identify the third quantity. But we know from the other evidence Mr. Lane had crack cocaine on a daily basis. And we know from the evidence that if Mia Kelly had any crack cocaine, it was really Mr. Lane's. So as we argue in the brief, by process of elimination, these drugs in the bedroom had to be Mr. Lane's.
What about this witness of yours who kept mentioning the defendant's criminal history?
Well, I thought that's unfortunate. I don't know about kept mentioning.
Well, there was more than one occasion when
twice he said things about it.
Stuff was blurted out about him having been in custody, or references to asking for a lawyer, etc.
That was the police officer.
That's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
and
the police.
You had a separate reference to from a lay witness about
Mr. Barnes
having spent some time in custody.
That's correct. What about it? Well, it's one of those unfortunate things that occurs during a trial, despite the prosecutor's best efforts to instruct witnesses not to mention criminal history, not to mention those sorts of things. And I believe the record reflects that this prosecutor said she did not expect that testimony. And I believe, I can't recall whether she said she had instructed the witness, but there's a dialogue between the judge and the prosecutor indicating that this was an inadvertent mention. I'm sure some of you know from your trial experiences. The judge quickly realized this was a witness who wasn't completely out of control, but no, he was going to say what he knew, and it sort of didn't matter how he'd been instructed. And so the judge took control and said, let's get through these foundation questions by asking leading questions. Well, she asked a leading question. Did he live in Chicago? And the guy still volunteered the inappropriate information. So, I mean, it's unfortunate, but the government did not make any use of it. And these things happen.
That was a lay witness. Connolly, the officer to testify about him asking for a lawyer is that certainly improper.
Improper, should not have happened. I was surprised with the years of experience that he had that he wouldn't have realized that. I mean, clearly it is different than some of the cases where the defendant has simply asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege and not said anything. This is a case where the defendant did actually respond to questions, and then when told that there was 4 ounces of crack cocaine found in the house, he said, well, I need a lawyer. But I thought that the district court judge handled it very well and very quickly jumping right on top of it before the defense counsel even made any objection and instructed the jurors that it was completely appropriate for the defendant to have made that statement at that time, as we all agree it clearly was. I thought it was handled well in the district court, commendably by the district court judge, to address that immediately.
Did the district court judge in the instructions address it? In the instructions to the jury, was it addressed?
The instruction to the jury was immediately stated after this comment was made.
Anything during the final instructions?
I don't believe so. No, I don't believe so. When the other issue came up with Mr. Barnes, of course, defense counsel was asked, do you want me to give an instruction? And defense counsel said, no, we do not want a cautionary instruction. Was there an additional cautionary instruction? I apologize. I can't recall.
I'm talking maybe during the meeting that counsel sat with the judge after the evidentiary portion, where you go over the jury instructions.
No, I understand what your question is.
Did defense counsel raise the issue, to your knowledge?
I just cannot recall the record of the instruction conference. That's a good question, and I do not recall what happened in the instruction conference or the final instructions. I feel fairly confident that had it been one of the final instructions, it would have been in our brief. And so I'm thinking maybe I read the instructions and did not find it. But, of course, I would be pleased to supplement, and I can certainly easily review the record and address that if that's something the court would like. So let me know.
We will let you know if we
think it's
important.
All right. If you have no further questions,
okay.
Return the rest of my time to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Nash.
Very briefly regarding...
We'll raise the podium there for you.
I wasn't sure where the button was. when the government talks about the logic that the jury would go through regarding the cocaine, I can only call to mind the logic that they might go through in their discussions regarding Johnny Lane. This is an individual who's been in and out of jail, been dealing drugs, gotten parole, violated his parole, and then when confronted with the fact that he's found, because that's the inference to take from Officer Connolly's testimony, with a lot of crack cocaine, says, I want a lawyer. Could there be a better picture of a defendant from a layperson's point of view of why they should find him guilty? That's the effect that those inadvertent, I think for the most part unintended, one has to wonder about the police officer who did have 8 years of experience mentioning that. He can't have not known that it was wrong. And he did mention it. And that's not a little aside. That's a pretty big aside, if we want to call it. But that's what the jury was on its mind. The prosecutor didn't have to say anything to them. It was the pink elephant.
Do you agree, though, that Judge Mim, under the circumstances, handled this as a... best he could by quickly admonishing the jury to disregard the comment?
Actually, what he told them was it's perfectly acceptable for him to ask for a lawyer.
A perfectly acceptable request to make. But
a reasonable
draw
request.
No inferences from that.
The jury, of course, would say, of course, that's a reasonable request. If you're a dope dealer and they found whatever the amount of cocaine, in your house, and it's going to be attributable to you, asking for a lawyer is a smart thing to do. But it's also a pretty good indication of guilt from a layperson's point of view. Add to that, in and out of jail, parole violation. They don't have to know much more. And when the government argues the logistic, the syllogisms that they put in their brief regarding possession of the cocaine, with due respect to Mr. Hartzler, those are faulty. And the only evidence that the government relied upon in the district court was Connolly's opinion. And what Connolly was telling them was what the clothes said and what the wallet said. And in this case, the search warrant, which is part of the record, said any indicia of residence.
Mr. Nash, what's the difference between the judge admonishing an unfortunate statement made by the officer and defendant remaining silent, not testifying during a trial, and the judge instruction the jury that he has every right to remain silent, basically, quote-unquote, not testify? What's the difference?
Well, I think there's a great deal of difference.
Can't they see a defendant here, who's sitting
here,
there?
He's saying that the defendant, recognizing his at risk, says, I want a lawyer. In the trial setting, he's not saying anything. It's just the judge trying to tell the jury something that we all believe. We can't do much more, but we all suspect the juries think about that. I mean, all the way back to, I think it's Della Poli, I can't remember which judge it was, says it's kind of hard for us to think that they don't discuss it or think about it. But in this case, that's what the officer said. And then you add into it the two seemingly inadvertent comments about being in and out of jail, parole violation. And remember, what the government is seeking to prove then is that he was dealing drugs in Chicago. Everybody appearing in the district court deserves a little bit better than that. And as an answer to your Judge Sykes's question about the 851 notice, the wording is on page 17 of our brief. Basically, you get the dates and the jurisdiction right, and after that, it's not too correct. If there are no other questions, I'll sit down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both sides. The case will be taken under advisement. And Mr. Nash, you were appointed in this case, and we do thank you for your vigorous advocacy. I must say I really enjoyed your brief, and a few of the gems, like in an attempt to gild its less than bright lily, very nice, and at a different part where you were talking about corroboration, you said the crack in the bedroom addition for the part. I liked it.
Thank you, Jeff. I do enjoy your opinions, which made me think of those two copies.
All right, thank you. Thank you. And,